Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Allows us to explore our dark sides and find our way to the light. I celebrate people who, like the founder of the show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person, share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength, capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is Part Sinner, Part Saint with Late Night Poets on Blog Talk Radio, and we are part of allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but it's more fun if you are, because you can read and comment with us. I'm Afasiana, and with me I have Babbler. Hello, Babbler.
Hello. I've been really sick.
Oh, no. That sucks. You still sound like you got the scratchy throat going on. That's sad. Well, I hope you feel better soon. Thank you for calling anyway. Lost Babbler. She dropped, and here she goes again. One second.
Hello.
I think this is her. Yeah, hey, you're back.
Yep,
I figured you muted because you were coughing, but then I looked at the board and you were gone.
Yeah, no, randomly dropped less than talking. Sorry, but I am coughing a lot. I apologize. I've been sick for quite some time now. I'm getting really tired of being sick. I was really hoping I'd feel better, but I don't.
That sucks. I know. It's one that lasts a really long time. If you got the strain I had a few weeks ago, it's like never
it's
quite
not
feel
COVID,
normal.
So I've taken numerous COVID tests. So whatever it is, it's not COVID. But, yeah, it's been fun. My nose is just constantly running like a faucet, and I have this horrible, unproductive cough. Yeah, I've just been sleeping a lot. I mean, I've been working, too, because I'm going into audit season at work, so I really can't take time off right now. So it's been fun all around, Yeah, so mostly I've just been working and sleeping because I feel like a hot bag of poo. Oh.
Well, I mean, at least you're not a cold bag of poo.
I guess, yeah, I'm not a frozen bag
if you're
going to
be a mess,
sure
be a hot mess.
I'm better. But yeah, so I haven't had much going on. That's about it. Yeah. How have you been?
No, still a little bit sick myself, but not as bad lately. Tomorrow I'm doing a children's festival, so I'm like preparing myself mentally for the busyness of it, because I love the kids, I love my job, but also 500 people in a small space, I'm like, I will be having an anxiety attack, mm-hmm. I pretty much guarantee you. So I'm just trying to like mentally prepare for being surrounded by people, because I'm an introvert. But it should
That's
be
That's a lot of people in a small
time.
Space.
Right? I mean, I don't know how small the space is going to be, because it's there's multiple aspects to it, but my little area is not mm-hmm. huge. So it depends on how many people come into my zone. We shall see.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I wish you luck.
Thank you.
Whatever that looks like. You know, it's always like, when you have social anxiety, it's always like this balance of like, I hope there's enough turnout for you to feel good about what you've did, but not so much turnout that you feel overwhelmed by people. So whatever.
Right? Like I would like I want to reach lots of people, but little bits at a time. So like if they could come in groups of 20 and I serve people all day, then I'd be perfectly happy with that, because, you know, I reach like so many families. It's good. But at the same time, I'm not like, you know, hyperventilating. So we'll see. Anyway, I'm going to – the contest this week is called Lungs Full of Graveyards. And it was inspired by a quote by Matthew D. Ayer, which I kind of stumbled across on Facebook. And it says, I'm trying to scream, but my lungs are full of graveyards. I'm trying to see my dreams, and my eyes won't open. I'm trying to walk, but my feet are anchored in nightmares. I'm trying to love, and my heart is trapped in sadness. So that was the prompt. And I imagine we're going to have some dark rites, because as much as last time I was talking about how it was nice to have some levity, you know, I'm generally into the dark quotes. So we should have some deep entries, I think, to go with this.
That doesn't sound joyous and upbeat to you?
Oh, well, you know, maybe if you like graveyards, then having your lungs full of them could be interesting. You know, some friendly ghosts. Maybe you got Casper in there.
No, I look forward to seeing it. It's a great prompt.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to put you to work, Babbler, and get you to read our first poem.
All right. I apologize in advance if there's coughing. Not much I can do about it. This is Sanctimonious by Lakota Brody. Weeping willows, shades of sin, I am your silent entity. Let me in. Meadows of darkness, tombstones of past, this lethal situation may come to last. Consciously coming to the top of a hill, you recognize as a scar, as a grave that has not yet been filled. Cautiously counting on more days to come, you attempt relief, you start to run. Gripping at your wisdom, my claws hold fast. This is only the beginning of more days to pass. End poem.
Great read and wonderful poem, Lakota Brody. Now let's see. I like that it talks about like the sound of it too. I'm your silent entity. And the idea that there's the sound of it, because in the prompt, now I'm going to go back to the prompt to see if I'm making stuff up. Trying to scream, but not being able to. So being a silent entity, hoping to be let in, it's like that silence is not necessarily a true silence, but it's not being able to communicate. You recognize a scar as a grave that has not yet been filled. I love that line. I think that's the line that really strikes me. You recognize a scar as a grave that has not yet been filled. Gripping at your wisdom, my claws hold fast. And a scar, even if it hadn't been filled, thinking of it as a grave is one thing, because it's like you leave a piece of yourself, maybe, dead at the place where you got that scar, depending on the scar. And I don't necessarily mean a physical scar. It could be a metaphorical scar. And that's something that begins digging that grave. Really interesting interpretation. What did you think, Babbler?
Well, I really like the rhyme in this. The flow works really well. It almost feels like the opening of a horror movie. Like, it almost has thriller vibes, you know, the part of the thriller where it's narrated. It really kind of feels like that. Like, I can almost hear that kind of creepy voice reading it, like lines from the spoken portion of Thriller. But being addressed here by what feels like, you know, like your silent entity, whatever that may be, something of not good, you know, like, is it depression or is it horror or is it dread? It almost feels like dread, I think, fits it, you know, really, really well. You know, something that's like, here we go, like you're being consumed by something that's really not going to leave, you know. It's only the beginning, you know. It's almost like, what makes me think of is like the traumatic event that like leads to PTSD or leads to having anxiety problems or leads to, you know, long-term repercussions that are negative. You know, I have a general anxiety disorder as kind of part of my, you know, nice little mental health package. You know, it's so hard to describe sometimes when I'm going through a bad anxiety day, because it's like my skin is crawling. Like, I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. You know, I'm waiting to get fired, or I'm waiting for someone to call me and tell me that somebody's dead, or I'm waiting for someone to scream in my face, or I'm just waiting for me to fuck up. Like, and nothing happens. Like, 9 times out of 10, like, nothing happens. It's just I'm on edge all day because it's going to happen. And I feel like this piece really kind of recognizes that, you know. Weeping willow, shades of sin, I am your silent entity, let me in. You know, like, I'm coming. You know, like, I'm right on the cusp of being there. You know, this lethal situation may come to last. Consciously coming to the top of the hill, you recognize a scar as a grave that has not yet been filled. You know, just all the memories of bad things that have happened, and giving you that negative outlook on life, thinking that maybe never any good things are going to happen, just more bad things are going to happen because that's what happened in the past. You know, gripping at your wisdom, my claws hold fast. This is only the beginning of more days to pass. You know, life's full of shit, essentially. You know, you've had bad experiences and now you expect bad things to happen. I really liked it. I thought it was really well done. It had kind of a classic feel to it, this rhyme scheme. So, well done, Lakota Brody. I enjoyed it.
That was a great comment. You know, I really like how you related it to anxiety. I suffer from anxiety pretty intensely myself, and that feeling of waiting for something to go wrong is definitely awful. And I think that now that you've applied that to this poem, I see it in a really different way. So I really appreciate when I hear someone's interpretation. It makes me reconsider all of the lines. It's interesting how poems can go multiple ways, and that's a really cool thing about talking about poetry together.
Well, I agree. Yeah, no, I love it when I feel like I got a poem and then I hear someone else's interpretation and I'm like, oh my God, I totally see that. Like, yeah. You know, open-ended things, right? Art is interpretation.
Yes. Jenny Hunt, 2017, has been on the board, which is awesome. Hi, Jenny. And we also have an audio from her, so I'm going to play that audio. Sorry, we're at the end of the alphabet, and the audios are sorted by by the names of the shows. Okay, here we go.
Letting self-love win. Arguing with myself in my mahogany-colored wicker chair. Pulling at my fried burgundy frosty gray hair. I scream, hey, wicked subconscious. Stop being so pompous. Sick of your blanket lies, don't need your false eyes, or your inner betrayals, they're a psychosis gore. I just don't know what's true anymore. You refuse to let me believe the positive words spoken about me. Failed me too many times, convincing myself I'm nothing special. All I see is toxic red, always making me wish I were dead. The dark side of my mind is constantly shoddy. Please make it stop being so haughty. In need of a total brain recall, shutting you up now to let self-love lights in. Can't hurt me anymore. I won't let me. Get out of my head, my own self-loathing enemy. No more room for you. I'm letting love win. End poem.
Great read, Jenny. I think Babbler is having to mute because she's not feeling well, and that's okay. So I thought this was a fantastic audio. I know that you said that you're new to it, and it doesn't... one second. I posted the wrong link.
Oh. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, I was having a coughing fit.
I thought
yeah,
you might be.
Sorry. I posted it up there because the poem that was, the audio clip was wonderful. It just didn't match the poem I was reading. Did I open the wrong one?
How did I do that? Listen to deeper reading. Really? it's.
I don't know.
I was just listening. One second. I'm gonna play the beginning again and yeah. See. Cause I'm like, what? No, you're right. For some reason, I have the audio for letting self love win.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the what? I don't know how that happened. Okay. somewhere along the line, I got the wrong audio. So I apologize for that, Jenny. No, it was not you. It was either me or Phil, and probably me. So what we're going to do is I am going to read the poem that we have the link to, which is for the contest. And, right. And then I will, while you comment, I will try to dig up the words to the one that we just heard. Okay. So this this one is Read Between the Lines, There Is Always a Deeper Meaning. Fraudulent lies mistaken for believable truths. Adulthood too quickly traded in for my youth. Stuck in this paradox of washed-up life, anxiety and depression causing my mind strife. Believing I was okay is where you went wrong. Falling for my smiles, my laughter, my song. I had you thinking my weaknesses were gone, that I am again healthy-minded and strong. All the medications and therapy couldn't help me. Read between the lines, can't you see? Tears of laughter, look closer. A bad scene. Nothing can save this wretched, darkening soul. No one's touch, nor anyone's gentle, loving hold. My brain and heart now see eye to eye, no longer divided. We know it's my time. Too much stress for a good night's rest makes one fail life's biggest test. End poem.
Lovely read, Faziana. I liked this piece, you know, the fraudulent lies mistaken for believable truth, you know, it's so interesting, isn't it, how, like, some of the happiest looking people, the people who appear to be the most jovial and are often the most depressed, because they put on this face, you know, they put on, no one, then you feel, well, I shouldn't put it to other people, but at least when I feel depressed, I don't feel like anyone cares, you know, like, nobody wants to hear about how shitty I'm doing, like, nobody wants to hear that, like, you know, and it's really reinforced by the fact that, like, when people ask you, like, how you doing, you know, they really just want to hear, oh, good, how about you, you know, it's really more of a greeting than an actual giving a shit, you know, because if you were to answer that, like, legitimately every time, people would just be like, just don't even ask them how they are. And when you're not feeling well, like when you're depressed, it's usually associated with feelings of self-worth that are really low. And so, you know, to cope with that, a coping mechanism is to pretend that you're fine, you know, to go out into the world every day and put on a brave face and make it look like you're happy, laugh at jokes, maybe be the jokester, you know, be the one to make other people smile because you don't want to talk about how shitty you're feeling. And then at the same time, there's this kind of internal crisis that happens where then you're going, why does nobody notice that I'm not doing well? You know, like, why does nobody care? To the point where it's like, oh, I pretend to laugh and nobody notices that anything is different with me. Like, nobody seems to notice that I'm not okay. Which is kind of a double-edged sword because it's like you're walking around wearing this mask, but you have these unrealistic expectations of other people. But that's not really how depression works. You know, it doesn't really care about logic. Like, you know, so, you know, this story of, like, you know, I'm trying to look, you know, happy. I really love the line, adulthood too quickly traded in for my youth, because you usually read it the other way around, you know, youth traded in too quickly for adulthood. But when you're pretending to be happy, when you're pretending to be joyful, you know, it can feel like that. When you're trading in responsibilities and mature thoughts for silly games. So I thought that was a really great line. You know, and then to feel bitterness at other people not really noticing that you're not okay. You know, I had you thinking my weaknesses were gone, that I am, again, healthy-minded and strong. All the medication and therapy couldn't help me read between the lines, can't you see? You know, and nobody noticing. And then that last stanza is particularly dark. You know, my brain and heart now see eye to eye, no longer divided. We know it's my time. Too much stress for a good night's rest makes one life fail the biggest test. That could be, you know, a suicide potentially. It could also be, you know, just feeling completely unworthy. You fight this mind game, play this mind game with yourself all the time, and you have two voices in your head going, I don't matter. And, you know, it's more rational side saying, no, you do. And when the, you know, the depressed side wins, you know, it's really depressing, you know, and life's biggest test could also just be like finding meaning, you know, being happy, being fulfilled, you know, the joys in life that are what you're supposed to live for when you're not feeling those, you know, on both levels, like you just don't even have it in you to argue with yourself anymore. You know, it's really dark. It's really dark. It makes me think of, you know, some of the better cognitive therapy moments that I've had. And I remember having this discussion about the way I talk to myself versus the way I talk to other people, you know, and if it's not something I would say to somebody else, then it's not something I should be saying to myself. You know, if I think about, you know, the source of my trauma and who I was when those things happened and how I was such a, you know, a little girl, like, and the thoughts that I have about myself, like, would I say that to someone? You know, would I say that to a little girl that age? Is that a thought I would even have about them? And the answer, if the answer is no, then I really shouldn't treat myself like that either. Then that's not a fair thought to have. So anyway, this is something I just found really helpful. Not that, obviously, I understand poetry is not always direct. You know, it's not always like 100% like what's going on. But just, you know, makes me think of these things, like when I've had these thoughts, when I've had these feelings and been in a place that felt similar to that, just, you know, things that have helped me through those times. Anyway, I really liked it. I thought it was great, even though it's really depressing, but that's kind of the point, right? Poetry is emotive. Doesn't have to be good feelings. Or at least not upbeat ones. So, thank you, Jenny. Aphasiana, what'd you think?
I really liked it once I figured out the confusion of, I was kind of lost for a little bit about what was what, but it was my bad because the audio that I played was the audio for my other show, Double Helix, so I mixed up my shows, so that was why. My bad, I'm sorry, Jenny. In any case, I really enjoyed this poem. You know, it's an odd thing to say sometimes when you enjoy a poem about depression. I don't enjoy that people feel the depression. I enjoy the way that it's being expressed so that people can talk about it and you know, help each other deal with these feelings. And Babbler, I thought your comment had so much wisdom in it. And you're right, there's a bit of a paradox in we try so hard to cover up our weaknesses, to hide the fact that we have anxiety and depression, and then we resent people for not reading between the lines, you know, even though we don't say directly how we're feeling, we do want someone to care enough to see through, and it can be really painful when nobody does, or when it feels like nobody does. But your mind does lie to you, and, you know, even when people do care, it questions that. And I like what you said, Babbler, about, you know, don't say things to yourself that you wouldn't say to someone else. If it's too mean to say to someone else, it's too mean to say to yourself. I thought that was a good comment to make. You know, tears of laughter look closer. It's a bad scene. They're not actually tears of laughter. They're just tears. I thought that was, you know, powerful. The brain and the heart now seeing eye to eye. What's that like? Because I don't feel like mine ever agree. But when they both agree on the bad thing, that's tough. this is good. It delves into some deep topics, and, you know, I appreciate that it does that. So thank you, Jenny. And I'm going to talk about your other poem on my other show. So I'm sorry that I messed up the audios there. I got too excited seeing that you had an audio, and I clicked the wrong thing. Now that you have audios on more things, I got to keep aware that there's more options, which is wonderful. It's nice to have you start doing audios. So, we're going to try again to do an audio for G.A. Grimm this time. And let's see.
Hey, that's my line.
Looking for a Life Jacket by G.A. Grimm. I am sorry. These weak words and cliches are my only armor. Paper thin, though cutting. Making us all stained. While time is running away, leaving me behind. They say beauty is only skin deep. So I averted my gaze. There's nothing beautiful here. If the world had eyes, it still would not see. Just like me. My heart was water. I got drunk. Now I thirst. My hope, an ocean. They got crossed, dropping stones overboard, causing waves and waves on the surface, from the deck, then sinking. What's done is done, to each his own. And if you cannot read between the lines, perhaps your eyes are closed too.
Wonderful SoundCloud. Thank you, G.A. Grimm. I really enjoyed the pacing of this piece. These really short lines give it kind of a bleak feel that I think works really well with this subject matter, you know. And I think the point of this piece is, you know, trying to say what you mean without saying it directly, you know, being limited by words and cliches, trying to express yourself without being direct, because you just can't really bring yourself there. Like, you can't really do it. So you just got to listen, you know, and pay, you know, close attention to people, you know, and how that can feel really exhausting. There's some really great lines in here in particular that I really liked. I really loved, you know, my heart was water. I got drunk. Now I thirst, you know, to feel empty, used. You know, I thought that was a really great way of expressing how you feel empty and used, like your heart being a glass. You know, that's empty, which is almost worse. It's worse than just being empty because it was full. So, like, you know the feeling of feeling full, of feeling satisfied, of feeling fulfilled. And then to have that removed feels so much more vacuous than to have never had that to begin with. You know, I also really liked an ocean that got crossed. Because it really gives that double meaning to crossed, you know. You know, of course you cross an ocean, but when something gets crossed, you know, it's usually like stabbed in the back, you know, manipulated and abused. So I thought that was a really great use of double meaning of that colloquialism there, you know, to get crossed. You know, and it's a long and arduous journey anyway on top of being used. You know, and then these rocks that you're throwing overboard that go down into, you know, the deep ocean, I thought was a really great way to segue from that into feeling really down, really alone, you know, and to not see the beauty in things, you know, to turn your head away from the good things in life. So I really liked this. I thought it was really texturally interesting. I thought there were some great metaphors in here that kind of flow from one to the other. You know, with themes of, like, betrayal and depression and sadness. And also this concept of water from the glass to the ocean to the sinking stones felt really nice to just flow from one to the other. So I thought this was a great poem. It felt slow and profound and melancholic. So I liked it. Thank you. What did you think, Ephesiana?
I really enjoyed it. I like what you said about the pacing, because it did have some great pacing. And I mean, I always find that his audio has wonderful pacing, but having the very short lines helps us recognize that pacing, even just as readers, even if we didn't get to hear it in his own wonderful voice. I loved the beginning where the words are his armor and it's paper thin. That idea of like only having the protection of what you say and what you write, it's making us all stained. So he's getting stained by the ink of what is being said too. And I mean, you can give yourself paper cuts. So like, I don't know, it just works really great as a metaphor. And then to think that beauty is only skin deep, you know, it's just like how the paper is so thin. The beauty is also really thin. So he tries not to see the beauty, to fall for the mirage of beauty, you know, maybe a beautiful partner who is not so kind. And, you know, when it says there's something beautiful here, it seems like it's something that he's trying to tell himself, like, nothing to see here kind of thing, like, don't look. And if the world had eyes, it would still not see, because there is no actual beauty below that surface. And then there's all the water metaphors that work really well. I like what you said, Babbler, about crossed and how it can work in multiple ways. And then the end, if you cannot read between the lines, perhaps your eyes are closed too. You know, maybe people are not letting themselves see the beauty that goes beyond the surface. Maybe they're afraid to see the beauty beyond the surface. So then they have to see, you know, that more people deserve better, or that you know, their views were maybe shallow before, and that there's more to see, and to admit that is hard. So they have their eyes closed to what's between the lines. I thought this was really interesting. Thank you for giving us the audio as well.
Excellent comment. Where are we off to?
Now we have stagnant. Could you read that, please?
Absolutely. This is Stagnant by Hosk, or Hosk, I don't know. It goes like this. The trees are elephant hide. The grasses are vexed thunderhead. The rocks are monolithically conformist with one another. The flowers are graphite, and the dirt is powdered lead. It is twilight, and there is a corpse in the water. The lips are cloudless noon sky. The eyes are snotite beds. Hairlocks are hieroglyphic algae, contorted and spun together. Thighs, broken, fried cherry pies. Submerged chest, a busted cardinal nest. It is twilight, and I am coerced into the water. The cricket's tune is anthracite. The mud is velvet thread. Into the thick crud, rose toes bite, as bugs mourn the dead. It is twilight, and there are corpses in the water. End poem.
Excellent read. Okay, I confess there was one word I did not know the Snoddite beds. So I looked it up. And they look gross. So they are slimy, dripping stalactites made of goo that contain bacteria in abundance and beautiful microscopic gypsum crystal formations. So, yeah, I can see why it's called Snoddite, because it looks like the cave just has, like, a runny nose. Biovermiculations. You know? Ick. Which makes it a wonderful word choice. As much as I'm like, oh, I'm going to gag, that is a successful thing in this poem, because that the eyes look like that. That really brings that corpse, I was going to say to life, but more like to death in our images, in our mental images. And like to not say the lips are blue, but to say the lips are a cloudless noon sky. I mean, that is a way of saying they're blue. Very well done. the hair, being hieroglyphic algae, consorted and spun together. Like, that is just a brilliant way of describing that. I love that. And, like, the thighs being, like, fried cherry pies. Like, oh, my God. It's using what could be a beautiful thing, a cherry pie, and turning it into something so disgusting that I'm, like, in awe of this is really cool and really gross at the same time. So well done. It is, I'm looking at the comment, and Pam said it's visceral imagery. And yes, I would say visceral is a really great way to describe this. And it's really fitting, you know, with the prompt, because we're talking about the lungs and the eyes and the feet and how everything is, you know, pulled down by that sadness. And she did that. She took that metaphor to the next level, and just really intensely did so. Well done. What did you think, Babbler?
I really liked it. Just the description, the descriptive language is really just gorgeous. First of all, the title is stagnant, you know, unmoving, stuff that's not going anywhere. You know, stagnates, you know. The trees are elephant hide, and I instantly picture, like, that rough, cracked bark, you know, and the grasses are vexed thunderheads. Even the grass is, like, gray and dreary, and it's because it's twilight. You know, the sun is going down. Everything is kind of thrown into relief. So, like, the landscape is in black. You know, and the only color that's really left is, like, that dulling color of the sky. And it's just beautifully described with, you know, powdered lead dirt and graphite flowers. The descriptive language in this piece is really exceptional. You know, again, the Snoddite beds, you know, just like those tendrils of goo. That's all that's really left is the eyes, you know, algae in the hair. I also really love the exposed thighs, broken fried cherry pies. Like, it rhymes, which is just really satisfying. But then on top of that, I picture, you know, a leg that is in a state of decay where the muscle is exposed and has been pecked at and kind of torn into to the point where it looks like cherry pie filling. Like, and just how kind of disgusting that is, and yet so well depicted in so few words. I mean, you know, that's six words that just described, you know, the decay of a thigh. You know, really well done. And then, you know, the crickets tune this anthracite, the mud is velvet thread, into the thick crud. Crud really stood out to me because it's a really common word, but I do not recall the last time I actually read a poem that has the word crud in it. But it's such a good word. Like, there's something really satisfying about saying crud. Like, it's, I think it's because that, like, that vowel sound really goes low, you know, crud. It's good. It's a very basal sounding word that I enjoyed. You know, as the bugs mourn the dead, you know, so I'm picturing, like, all these crickets and maybe, like, the scuffling sound of maggots if things are really quiet. And the way that, you know, all of the bugs in the water and the small animals and the bacteria that are breaking down this body are really kind of forming their own dirge, you know, their own mourning. And yet feast at the same time. You know, it is twilight and there are corpses in the water. It sounds really foreboding and really frightening, but it's really just a depiction of a body rotting in water, like in a pond or a swamp or a really still lake. And it's just, like, deliciously disgusting. So I enjoyed it very much. So extremely well done. Thank you, Pause Kennedy. Wonderful piece. Very natural.
Deliciously I like that. it is. It really is. All right.
Yeah. Great, great write. Loved this one. Where are we off to?
I'm going to read one by Ben Hart, and this is called Only a Dream Away. I heard heaven's full of music, and hell is full of art, and by tomorrow more of my skeleton will have ground itself to dust to fill in my hourglass heart. It's always hated birthday cakes. Still, I'll do another year, go round again for no reason. But why is it that the instant flame gets to be destroyed when I wished it to be me who was leaving? They tell me I am not 21 anymore, and you'd think by now I'd learned that most of the time the moment is more important than the day, and that by this moment tomorrow, more of my brain will have burned away. In the rhapsodic forest fires, the perceptual invasion that once began at my eyelashes and then slipped behind the liar's eyes to burn the tears I had saved for a special occasion. I lose everything I love. Every day upon waking to a life of digging for change on purgatory shores, because I was a penny short and Sharon didn't operate on charity. I said I had a dream, and you stripped it naked to find its verity, and I faulted you for reeling me back in from the ocean of smoke on the ceiling. Come on, little pugless heart, don't give out on me now. I am a ship made of matchsticks, adrift on anxious tides, waiting for the lightning to strike so in smoke I may rise and take my place among the skies before, by tomorrow, more of my mind will have calcified to ensure that even in the fleeting of everything, I would never fit in. And your acidic eyes left their troubles under my skin as you slipped in through the windows and never left again, holding me captive in your gaze and in the desperate attempt to ease me as much as you had hurt me. You boldly proclaimed with no way of knowing, tomorrow is only a dream away, and the breaking is the only way out of the maternal maze that is our tender aching, and I, for one, am going. End poem.
Great read, Ephesiana. And what a twisted piece. I really enjoyed this, but you know, I heard heaven's full of music and hell is full of art. There's a really interesting opening line. I just kind of wanted to delve into this. Like, what would that mean? You know, like, is the music of heaven artless? You know, I instantly picture, like, the religious Renaissance pieces that show, like, decapitations and, like, the flaying of Marseilles and things like that. Like, the really dark and violent Renaissance art as, like, the art of hell, you know? Or like all of those art, like conservative parents are like, it's the devil, you know, is being in hell. It's kind of interesting, you know. It's just a really interesting couple of lines that my brain instantly wanted to delve into, which is a great way to open a piece, you know. And then lead into, and by tomorrow, more of my skeleton will have ground itself to dust to fill in my hourglass heart. Is like, you know, every day that you're alive is another dream dead, which is just like the opposite of saying that, you know, like tomorrow is always another opportunity. You know, today is the first day of the rest of your life. You know, it's taking the glass half empty version of that and just being like, you know, today just means yesterday happened and I'm one day closer to being dead, one day closer to not achieving shit. It's really kind of depressing, but it's an interesting perspective, and I do appreciate it, you know. Always hated birthday cakes because it just reminds you that this is another year where you haven't accomplished what you wanted to accomplish. And you're getting older, you know, they tell me I'm not 21 anymore. And so you'd think by now I'd learned that most of the time the moment is more important than the day. And that by this moment tomorrow, more of my brain will have burnt away. You know, life really is kind of made up of key moments, right? Like the older you get, the more you have to look back on, the more time you kind of spend dwelling in the past, which is kind of funny, you know, because it's like you simultaneously are more aware of the importance of a moment because you've experienced more of life. And so you understand that like those moments are really what you have, you know, that's really what is weighting you down and really the sum of your experiences. And yet the longer you dwell on the moments you've had, the less you're living in the present, and the more you're living in the past, and the less moments that maybe you're making for now. It's kind of an interesting, you know, paradox. You don't want to be spending time dwelling in the past, but at the same time, what are memories is not little dwellings in the past. I enjoyed that. And then, of course, you know, capped again with that existential dread kind of, you know, every day just a little more dead. So enjoyed that as a thought, you know. I lose everything I love every day upon waking to find a life of digging for change on purgatory shores because I was a penny short. You know, it's interesting. The longer you live, the more you lose, right? Living is the privilege, but, you know, the ways that you pay for that privilege is watching, you know, the people who don't get that privilege. You know, the longer you live, the more people you will know who've died. The longer you live, the greater chances that you will know someone who's lost a child or someone who's been hit by a car or someone who died of cancer or, you know, it's because these are experiences. And so the longer you live, the higher risk you have of exposure to these things. And so it's true, you know, you lose things as you live. You also gain things. If you never lived, you would have never had them to begin with to lose. You know, it really is taking a good look at the double-edged nature of living, right? You know, and then to this part where I said I had a dream and you stripped it naked to find its verity. That's not very nice. You know, like if you have a dream, you know, hopefully you're not surrounding yourself with people who are just like, do you really? Like, your dream's shit. Like, okay. I mean, unless your dream is something terrible, you know, like, I'd really like to be a serial killer. I would have loved to have killed 15 people by the time I'm 35. Okay. You know, like, unless you're, like, that level of deranged, like, most people's dreams aren't like that. So, you know, it's kind of sad if you're surrounded by people who are shitting on your dream. You know, but it could also be, like, why you maybe have a twisted outlook on life if that's the kind of people that you have around you telling you that your dream's crap. You know, I grew up pretty rough. You know, my dream was to get out of that. My dream was to be financially comfortable, to not worry about having to find food, not worry about transportation. I've achieved those things, which is weird to even think about. But you know, even living in the trailer park, you know, the people around me were more like, that's going to be really hard. You know, like, why bother? Life sucks. It wasn't like your dream sucks. It was like your chances are slim. which I think is a different outlook. But that just kind of broke my heart. Like, whoever's with you is, like, testing your dreams. It's kind of harsh. I loved the ship made out of matchsticks to drift on anxious tides waiting for lightning to strike so in smoke I may rise. It really has this beautiful imagery of helplessness. You know, you're just kind of floating around directionless, just hoping for, like, this tiny sliver of chance that maybe you'll be lit a fire. It kind of reminds me, too, of, like, a Viking funeral from an imagery kind of sense, you know, to light this vessel on fire on the seas, which I think dovetails nicely with the theme of death and ending that kind of happens in these rites. So it kind of brought my thought there with the imagery of the matchstick ship. You know, just this idea that every day your dream slips away a little more. It's dark and it's depressing, and every day you're a little closer to dead. It's definitely a dreary piece, but it's really well textured. And there's some really wonderful metaphors and imageries in here that I really enjoyed. Like, there are several stanzas, several of which I've already done, where I could really just kind of dip into and mentally explore them much more deeply than is touched upon in this piece, which is great. I love exploratory writing. I love writing that has lines that make me want to think about what does that mean, what does that look like, what are the implications of that thought, because that's just who I am. I'm an overthinker, so there you have it. I really liked it. Great write, Ben. Dark, depressing, very pessimistic write, but with beautiful imagery. So, well done. Abaziana, your thoughts?
I really, really loved this. Like, I just added it to the finalists. Like, I'm like, I haven't read everything yet, but you know what? You're up there. I think that it really captured the heaviness of the prompt in the metaphorical sense, and also in the way that it uses the body in the metaphorical ways. The skeleton grinding itself to dust to fill the hourglass. It's just, like, incredible. I love that. And then talking about the little tiny flames on the cake getting to be extinguished before they have to become a big, painful fire is really interesting. And it talks about, like, how he wishes he was the one who was leaving. And then that part that you were talking about where he's the matchstick boat that could be struck by lightning, I feel like that really connects to that part because, like, maybe instead of those little flames, he could have gone out in flames and it would have been, you know, a big ending that felt right to him. And I immediately went to the Viking funeral too. I thought that's just because I'm really into Viking stuff, but that it worked for you too. I think maybe that's where he was actually going. And I thought that worked fantastic. The idea of the boat being made of the matches, it's really cool. I kind of want to try to make a Viking ship out of matches now and, like, do some kind of ceremonial thing at some point where I light it. I don't know when I'm going to do that, but if there's a day where I have, like, a pet fish that dies or something like that, it's going to get a Viking ship made out of matches because that's just cool. is it weird to be planning the death of a pet I don't have? I'm not going to kill it, I promise. Yeah, that's one of those dreams that it's okay to crush, you know, like you're saying, if your person is dreaming of serial killer type things. I liked, once began at my eyelashes and then slipped behind liar's eyes. That's really unusual phrasing, and I love it. I also loved the connection to Greek mythology, where it's talking about the ferryman, and he was a penny short to get to the other side, so now he's stuck in purgatory. So I kind of see that as, like, maybe being, like, in hospice or something, where you're not fully living you're not getting out there and exploring and getting to do all the things that you would like to do, but you're also not dead. So he feels like he's, like, trapped in this in-between world of not really experiencing anything, and that's why he kind of wishes it was just over. Well, it sounds like he's not actually actively suicidal, and I'm hoping this is just the character and not Ben himself. When I'm talking about that, I'm talking about it as a character. Ben, we love you. I hope this is not reflective of how you feel. It's okay not to be okay, but also we're going to get you okay. So I thought that was brilliant, the way that it worked in the ferryman there. And I was pretty sure that's who it was, but I looked it up to make sure I wasn't being dumb. And then when I looked it up, it was talking about putting the coin in the mouth. And I had always thought of it as putting the coin on the eyes, but I think different cultures put it in different spaces. But many of them within their mythologies did kind of pay for a trip to the afterlife. So I just find that interesting. Sometimes the mouth, sometimes the eyes, but somewhere you got to pay that ferryman to be taken away. And he feels like he's stuck in purgatory because he didn't manage to do whatever he has to do to move on. So that was a clever spot there. I already talked about the ship. Yeah, I mean, I could go on and on. I really, really enjoyed this piece. It's just beautiful and dark. And the way that it described the mind going away made me think that maybe there was dementia or Alzheimer's or some kind of thing, because it was like the brain will have burned away, the brain will have calcified. It's that fear of losing who you are, losing the ability to think, losing the ability to maybe remember, and day by day, it's getting worse, and you want it to end before you're not truly yourself. So that was kind of the vibe I got, was dementia being a concern.
Nice. I like that take. Yeah, and like you said, hey Ben, I don't think this is autobiographical, but just in case, we're here.
We love you.
What do we have up next?
I have a brevity for you, so you don't stretch your throat too much.
Yeah. All right, this is Suicide by T.G. Rain. They're making me ill. Hello, stone is going to rape the atmosphere. Die, you Lucifer worshipping flags. End poem.
So that was definitely a brevity. And I think it's a haiku. Someone in the comments says it's a non-traditional one. I am not the greatest with form poems. They're challenging to make everything fit in there. I like the word slags. I don't know why, but I just Yeah. I hear it in an accent, too. Hello, stone is going to rape the atmosphere. You know, honestly, I feel like there's stuff that I don't understand because I don't know the stone reference there. Hello, stone. But I admire his succinctness. It's not something I can do. And I like the wordplay of the title, because I think suicide is talking about suicide, but it's like the poopy side of life is the reason why there's suicide. So suicide, and also it kind of gives that, again, like sounds almost like a British accent, suicide. Okay, that was terrible. But, you know, something about the way that it's written makes me feel like it's a play on that word, and I think that that is clever. What did you think?
Well, I also really liked that brevity. Duality of that, the wordplay on the title, suicide. You know, it's a pretty short and angry piece. You know, they're making me ill. Hello, Stone is going to rape the atmosphere. Die, Lucifer worshipping slags. You know, it's very angry. You know, there's bitterness in this. And, you know, when I read Hello, Stone, there's two ways I could take this. It's like, hello, Stone is going to rape the atmosphere, which is, makes me think of, like, headstones. You know, like, the fact that we're giving them attention, the fact that we're leaving memorials for people who killed themselves, and maybe they don't approve of that. Like, maybe they think suicide is super wrong, and shouldn't be, you know, acknowledged or memorialized. I don't know. I've met people before who felt like that, depending on, you know, your perspective on suicide. But I also read it as like a wordplay on Hellstone, you know, being, you know, like an ore from the underworld, which, you know, is like almost like a Minecraft reference at this point, which just seems kind of funny until you get to the double use of the word slag. You know, like it's the British slang, but slag is also, you know, stony waste matter that you get when you refine ore. So, you know, which I'm kind of like, okay, so are we talking about, like, burning in hell, like melting headstones in hell? And then that's why it's their slag. I don't know, there's some interesting wordplay in this piece. It's short, it's angry, it feels very bitter. But there's some interesting use of language going on in such a short write. I found it very fascinating. So thank you, T.G. Ray.
All right. I feel like you've enlightened me. And as you were talking, I'm thinking, of course the stone is the headstones because it's, the quote is about graveyards in your lungs. So,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And the slag comment also makes sense, the burning in hell. Yeah, headstones are kind of a hot topic right now in my city because the city just changed it so you can't, like, leave stuff at graves. Because I guess, you know, people were leaving lots of little trinkets and things, and it was, like, blowing around in the wind, and it just became, like, this big mess, and then people were going around and, like, stealing things. So it was, like, the graveyard was quite the scene. So they've banned having stuff other than real flowers, and people are really mad about not being able to leave fake flowers and things. It's like a battle of petitions and protesters and stuff right now, and I'm kind of the mind of I don't want to take up space when I'm dead. Like, the whole world could be graveyards if we all get a spot like that. So I'm like, just like, either, I don't know, get rid of me in some way that I'm not taking up space. But it's just, it's been such a battle that I can see how people would get in fights over things. I see both perspectives. And not specifically for people who've committed suicide, just like everyone. Feed me to the earth. All right. Now I'm going to read one by Daniel Deschino. Graveyard graffiti grafted and grifted. I hold the world internal, and it weighs heavy on my tired legs. My knees creak, and the ankles swell with every step. I hear the footprints of the fallen and the frantic relay race of the desperate. It's my fault. I open my senses to the world, and the world ravaged. Sight just seems now an illusionary trick of the mind from the past horrors. They have clawed into my brain, and they have found home. Even words have lost all meaning, as words that gather too many meanings will do. I try to write, but the pen always ends up impaled deep in my heart. Poetry seems a puncture wound, rhyming a wriggling arrhythmia. Prose, purposeless with its made-up mayhem. And the alluring advantage of alliteration, although appealing, appears absolutely appalling when aimed with abandoned awareness, apparently. With wanton whimsy, the words win. I wish I didn't see them. Hearing just hurts. Ice picks in the wind. Being touched feels like a spark of effervescent pitchforks, where every nerve ending is a tortured scream locked in the lights-off padded room. Smell just brings decay and destruction. I wish I didn't know that. This only leaves me taste, so I shut my mouth to protect. I don't speak. It just instigates the memories. I only open to consume, for then it is mine, and it is me. Is that what I've become? For my graveyard graffiti? End poem.
I really liked this piece. I really liked this a lot. We knew we were headed on a deep dive into alliteration with the title, you know, Graveyard Graffiti Grafted and Grifted. We knew we were kind of into a, going to touch on that to begin with. But this idea, to me, this is about, like, sensory overload. This is about being, like, overwhelmed by everything and wanting to experience it, but also wanting to shut it out. You know, the wanting to feel, but wanting to protect. And I think it does, like, a really great job of communicating that, you know, the feeling, the heaviness of holding the world internal, you know, with creaking knees and swelling ankles and trying to figure out how to, you know, experience it. And then you open it, yourself up and just become overwhelmed. You know, they clot into your brain and things have lost meaning because there's just too much going on all at once. You know, the pen always ends up impaled deep in my heart. Poetry seems a puncture wound, rhyming a wriggling as arrhythmia, prose purposeless with its made-up mayhem, the alluring advantage of alliteration, although appealing, appears absolutely appalling when aimed with abandoned awareness, apparently. It flows beautifully. Like, I can read that lightning fast without stumbling because it's just paired so nicely in both its alliteration, which is self-referential, but also just in the flow. You know, there's definitely alliteration where I can't read it. Like, it doesn't roll off the tongue. And this rolls off the tongue beautifully. I liked rhyming a wriggling arrhythmia particular because it none of them start with the same letter. But you still have the alliteration. Which I thought was really clever, you know, and the idea that poetry is a puncture wound. You know, you're trying to express yourself, and instead it feels like you're stabbing yourself. And this poetry, this rhymes and these alliterations just kind of flow out like it almost seems like you stabbed yourself in the jugular here, poetic jugular. I think it's really well done. I also really love the line, being touched feels like a spark of effervescent pitchforks. What a great way to describe that, like, weird tingly feeling of, like, nerve endings, you know, like dead arm. Effervescent pitchforks. I love it. I picture, like, almost like, you see, like, Disney's The Little Mermaid, Tritons. Oh, gosh, can't think of the word. The three-pronged weapon that's not a pitchfork, that trident, like being like zapped with those because those were like lightning infused, like a bunch of tiny ones, or like those little plastic cutlery ones that they put in to like hold your sandwiches together. Anyway, my brain goes to interesting places with that as a line. But I loved it because I thought it was a really great way to describe that feeling. And every nerve ending is a tortured scream locked in a lights-off padded room. Like, nobody even hears them or sees them. And it is funny. It's like when you have a dead arm, right, you can feel it, but other people really can't see it. Like, you feel like your limb is not functioning properly, and no one else seems to notice. It's kind of odd. Especially like you're walking on a dead leg. Like, wow, I feel like I'm limping everywhere, and no one else seems to even notice. Muscle memory is a wild thing. You know, and we go through all the senses here. You know, there's seeing, there's thing, there's smelling, you know, just through all kinds of different sensories, you know, senses, and then to get so overloaded. You know, I only open to consume, for then it is mine and it is me. Is that what I've become for my graveyard graffiti? And yet, there's not just consumption. We have this beautiful piece here. There's definitely creation, too, which is interesting because it's not really referenced in this piece, and yet that's just like where my brain goes. Maybe it's just me being contrarian, but, like, clearly you're not just consuming, because we have this wonderful right that comes from your consumption of the senses of the world. But I love the frustration of it. It has real ebb and flow and intensity. You know, it starts really kind of heavy and dark, and then it becomes really, like, loud. Like, if it was a piece of music, it'd go from, like, piano to forte here. Like, it's got real texture to the emotional range of it. It ebbs and flows. I really like it. I think it's really well done, Daniel. Thank you. Athena, your thoughts?
Well, that was a fantastic comment, and I like that you said that thing about the piano at the end, because he's actually been partnering with a pianist, and she's been writing music to his pieces, or he's been writing poems to her pieces, and they've been doing some collaborations that are really cool, where you get to listen to him read over the music, so I'm hoping
really
they'll do that. Yeah. We rarely get them for our contest because I think it takes quite a long time for them to, you know, work together. So our contests are too brief. But he sent me a few of them, and they've been wonderful. So Dan, if you're listening, you usually do the next day, I would love it if you could give this to your pianist friend and see if she would do some music to it. So please, please, please. I thought this was fantastic. I'm very demanding, you will find. I'm like, where's my audio? the way that this talks about sensory overload is so fantastic, and sensory overload is very big in my life. You know, with my brain damage, I experience things very differently than I used to, and you know, I definitely have my limits, and then I shut right down. I feel like this captures that overwhelming kind of feeling that you get. Where is it now? The way that it talks about the writing, you know, as a poet who tends to write about things that are painful. I really, really enjoyed to have that description of it, where the pen impales you, and the rhyming is that wriggling arrhythmia, the purposeless prose of mayhem. And his alliteration was fantastic. And we had actually just talked about alliteration last week, the week before, I can't remember, but he was saying he was going to write me a whole poem that was just alliteration. And I was like, dude, do you know how overwhelming that's going to be? I'm like, I love alliteration, but if it's every single word, it's like so freaking overwhelming, I can't handle it. And so, of course, he puts a whole bunch together. But like you said, it's not jarring the way it can be sometimes. It flowed so well. Alluring advantage of alliteration, although appealing, appears absolutely appalling when aimed with abandoned awareness, apparently. And I kind of wonder if the appears absolutely appalling was because I said, no, you can't do that. So, I don't know. I think he did an amazing job with the alliteration and with the reference of the difficulties of alliteration. And wanton whimsy, the words win. And it's hard not to give into that whimsy. And he talks about the words losing all meaning after a while. You know, when you're trying to make things work in writing and you're, like, looking at synonyms and you're going over things, and it's just, like, eventually you're so focused on the structure and the words that you've lost your essence, that you were trying to go for. Not saying that he did. I think he did fantastic here. But that is, it happens in writing. And the you already talked about this, Babbler, but the spark of effervescent pitchforks, I loved that so much. I mean, I have nerve problems, so I constantly have to deal with that. And I've never thought of it as effervescent, but that works so well. And the pitchforks, I also was picturing the little tridents like you were talking about, Babbler. And the little food ones was where my mind first went. And then when you're talking about, like, the Little Mermaid, I also thought about, like, Aquaman and his trident. So our minds went similar places on that. And the idea of them being a tortured scream locked in a padded room, because nobody hears you when you're in that padded room. And like you said, nobody tends to notice when you have that pins and needles feeling, unless you, you know, pull a me and fall down because you can't feel your leg properly. But
most of the time, no.
Just the way that it describes each of the senses in the way that it can hurt you. Hearing just hurts like ice picks in the wind. And yes, ice picks in the wind, I love. I've always thought of like ice pick at my temple, but to put it in the wind just makes it sound so much cooler. Just the way he captures the senses is so cool. And what I've become for my graveyard graffiti. It's a wonderful ending to this whole poem. Fantastic. Another one that just goes straight to the finalist list because wow. Wow. Amazing, Dan. Okay. I've posted one by Peter Selway, and that is for you, Babbler.
All right. This is Doctor Doctor by Peter Selway. Give me the news. Let me lament the mortal blues. Fred Astaire tapping my shoes, skeleton in corner. Serious prognosis. Doctor Doctor, is my life all over? Informed of latest treatment, only available in Switzerland. Discounting avalanche, Nazi invasion. A good chance of survival with rich, elderly men. End poem.
Great read. This is a real brevity for Peter, who tends to go for the, I'm trying to think of a way of saying super long ones. What's the opposite of brevity? Longevity?
Longevity?
Maybe. All right.
Verbosity.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I like the Fred Astaire reference, the tapping. I'm picturing him sitting on the, I was going to say bed. It's not really a bed. That kind of like slab that they have in doctor's offices. It's like metal. It has the little paper sheet on top. Sitting on there, I do tend to, like, kick my feet because it's way taller than I am, so, like, my feet can't touch the ground. You kick it, and your heels are touching the metal part, and it makes a funny noise. So that's what I think about when he says Fred Astaire tapping my shoes. I think about him kind of dangling his legs on that weird bed slab thingy. If you're sitting on it sideways, because if you sit on it the way you're supposed to, then your feet are in the stirrups, and I don't like that. So, unless you're pretending you're having a baby. I see him sitting sideways on it. And also, I see it as that song, Doctor, Doctor, give me the news. I don't know what that song is from, but I feel like it's an old thing. And
you sang it much lighter than it is in my head. In my head, it's like, doctor, doctor, give me the news. I've got a bad case of loving you. Like, it's like a rock song.
Oh, I think
it,
there was
like
a, like
Barbara. for barbershop.
Well, I hear it like barbershop. I think it was originally old school barbershop, and it got redone to be more rock. This is my theory.
Yeah,
I don't know this.
In my head, it's definitely a rock song.
I like that it kind of like poked at the only available in Switzerland, because that actually is a thing where that happens a lot. I had an aunt who had MS, and she had to go, I think it was Switzerland, to get an experimental surgery, and it helped for a little while. But, you know, still in its experimental stages, so not forever. But it, you know, things like that where you do have to be somewhat wealthy. I mean, not that my family is rich, but, like, you have to have the means to be able to try stuff like that, to, you know, to go to Europe to do something like that. You have to come from a place of privilege. And a good chance of survival with rich elderly men, that's usually who gets to do it. They, you know, if you are wealthy, if you are most likely white and an elderly man, those are the people who traditionally have power and the ability to survive. People who do not have a lot of money don't get the cutting-edge treatment. In fact, in places like the States, may not get treatment at all. You know, I'm fairly fortunate that I'm in Canada, so I did get treatment, even though I did not have money. But, I mean, even here, there's talk of privatization, and I'm like, no, I am so scared of what that will mean. I will not be able to afford treatment. But anyway, off my little soapbox, I think he did a wonderful job here. I think he is, you know, thinking about social commentary. That last part especially is a poke at the difficulties of surviving based on who you are. But that's not – that makes it sound like there's people who are better than other people, and that's not my intention at all. It's like your circumstances. What do you think, Babbler?
Well, I really like your take on it. You know, I agree. All of those things are here. You know, the lack of treatment availability, what it says about healthcare in the world, and how it's really kind of the best is reserved for, you know, the most privileged. You know, like people's lives are valued differently, unfortunately, and accessibility is given to those who are the most privileged. And so I think that is a great interpretation. I did have a second interpretation when I was reading this that kind of spins it on its head, because I instantly heard that song, "The Doctor, Doctor, Give Me the News, I've Got a Bad Case of Loving You." So then I viewed it from the perspective of being in love with somebody, you know, and you know, let me lament the mortal blues, you know, like, you know, going to die, like, loving someone that you're not supposed to, or that you can't have, or that you're the person that you love is going to die. You know, and then when I read, like, informed of latest treatment only available in Switzerland, I read that more in the context of only somewhere that's neutral, you know, like maybe it's a homosexual relationship or something like that, where, you know, you're not even allowed to be together unless you're somewhere that doesn't judge you for it. You know, and that, it's just not something you're allowed to have, you know, and the good chance of survival with rich elderly men, it just makes me think of like certain kinds of, you know, homosexual relationships. It makes me think of like, you know, the wealthy white men who kind of hide it on the side and pretend that they aren't. So, which could be totally wrong. It could be totally wrong. It's just the mindset that when I read Doctor, Doctor, Give Me the News, instantly I was thinking of the song in the context of that, you know, that of being in love with somebody that is maybe sick or ill or dying, and you're not even like allowed to be at their bedside or allowed to, you know, love them in the way that you do without judgment. So anyway, I thought it was a really great piece. I think it works well on either front. Definitely you know, my first interpretation was the same as yours, Aphasiana, but I had the kind of double twisting in my mind, just hearing the song in my head. So, interesting piece from Peter. Short for Peter. Liked it, though.
I like your interpretation, too. And, you know, it is true that, you know, not all love is accepted in all places. And he did make a comment to me once, not about homosexuality, but about kind of his sense of humor. And because I was like, hey, I like how edgy your stuff is. And he was like, well, in some places that gets you killed. I can't say it other than my writing or something like that. Like he kind of implied that he has to be careful what he says wherever he is. And again, with him, you could be, I don't know if that's literal, but it's true. In some places, you know, you could be punished for heresy, sacrilege kind of thing. I totally would. I'd be burned at stake as a witch for, like, so many times, I'm sure.
I'd be long dead. I'd be long dead, yeah.
Oh, yeah,
they were still
sure.
Doing witch hunts. I don't think I made it past the age of 5.
Same. I really believed I was magical when I was little. So, I mean, like, not only am I, you know, not so well-behaved woman in my later years, I probably would have, you know, pretended I was magic and got blown away.
I did not believe
yeah,
I was magic, but going out in the woods and making witch's brew was, like, one of my favorite things. So that one looked well.
Yeah.
My pet goat. Yeah, no. Dead.
Did you know that originally pockets were taken away from women's garments because men were afraid that they would have, you know, spells and things that they hid in their dresses that they could take out and use on people. So it was to prevent witchcraft that we were not allowed to have pockets. And then now there's, like, a resurgence of, like, women want pockets and everything. So there's, like, this joke going around of, like, witchcraft!
Witch!
Anyway, that amused me. I'm kind of a history nerd, and I also am obsessed with pockets, so it just worked out well. I'm like, all of my things in one thing? That's right. Okay. But yeah, I really like what you said there about
the pocketbook on witchcraft. Sorry.
The pocketbook on witchcraft that I could carry in a pocket. Oh my gosh. All right. I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna like have a pocket where I just always have that book, just to, you know, throw it to stick it to the man. But yeah, I really like your interpretation of that. I don't take back my interpretation, but I like the idea of it being like, you know, some things are not free to be in some places. And now I have the Bare Naked Lady song, Lovers in a Dangerous Time, in my head. I actually really like that song. Okay, I'm going to move along so we have time to read everything. This is When My Body is a Tombstone Without Candlelight by Hats. High above the cobwebbed fireplace, I store my silent self. I'm the reflection of your genius in the gray face of the moon. A midnight moment is the whimper of sleepless, empty embrace, while screaming at the top of husky voice, yet silence runs out of my lungs through cracked and bitten lips. Staring into ceiling, cobwebs dangling as tattooed pictograms, and my eyes yell, here I am, an aching skeleton. Mouth whispering, you're a fireplace in the winter, a cool lemonade in hot summer afternoons. Your laughter sounds like refreshing rain in the drought. My pale face hidden behind a curtain, eyes sunk into the damp white pillow, unnoticed. and poem.
Great read. First thing I noticed, about this piece, is just the structure. There's something very elegant in the way that it's structured. They're very short stanzas with interesting spacing on the lines, you know, different insets and tabs, and just the way it's set up. It gives it a very elegant feel, very kind of wispy, you know, but to store yourself high above a cobweb fireplace, so like to put yourself somewhere unseen and unnoticed, kind of forgotten, you know, to tuck away your genius, to hide, you know, the parts of yourself, you know, while screaming at the top of husky voice, yet silence runs out of my lungs through cracked and bitten lips, you know, to just want to yell and want to scream and have nothing come out, to be unheard, you know, to not be able to emote, you know, staring into ceiling, cobwebs dangling as tattooed pictograms, and my eyes yell, here I am, an aching skeleton, you know, just wanting to be seen but not saying anything, you know, eyes yelling is not always the most effective. It reminds me of what we were talking about earlier about, like, the masks people put on when they're depressed, you know, to look okay, to make yourself look okay, to come across as fine, and desperately want people to see that you're not fine, even though you're doing everything to indicate that you are, and just desperately want to be seen in that way, want people to take notice that you're actually not okay. And then mouth whispering, you're a fireplace in the winter, a cool lemonade in hot summer afternoons. Your laughter sounds like a refreshing rain in the drought. The good things about yourself, you know, trying to tell yourself the good things that you are, to talk yourself up, you know, to give yourself that boost, while crying in your pillow and not having anyone see you, you know, to desperately want to hear these things and feel these things, and not really know how. This is like quiet, and kind of almost like Victorian styled, you know, ache to this right that I really like. Like it's elegantly distraught. So I liked it. I thought it was beautifully done. Well done, Hats. Viviana, your thoughts?
I think your like two word descriptions of things is the best. Elegantly distraught. Is that what you just said? I love that.
Yeah.
I hope you comment that so she can see it, because that's amazing. It's like one of those like little things that you would write on the back of a book, you know, the like blurb from someone famous. Babbler says, elegantly distraught. Love it.
Maybe that's just how I'll leave my poetry comments. Maybe that's how I'll just start leaving my comments on poetry. I'll just put like Babbler says and then put it in quotes.
Yes, you totally should. I thought this was amazing. I like what you said about it being Victorian, because it does have that kind of feel to it. When I read the first stanza, high above the cobweb fireplace, I store my silent self, it made me think of this Maria Mena song that I used to be obsessed with a long time ago. And it goes, never mind me, never mind me. I'll just be shadows on your wall. Never mind me, never mind me. I can't remember the freaking tune, but it's like it's something about like I'll just be invisible. You know, once you've taken what you wanted, I'll just be the shadow on the wall. And when it's talking about the tombstone without the candlelight, it's like there's not even that flicker. She's just silent there, and not even the shadow there. I'm the reflection of your genius. So it's like, it makes me feel like she's a trophy. She's above the fireplace, and she's not her own person. She's just something that reassures the dude that he's awesome. You know, it really makes me feel like she's the trophy being there on the fireplace. And the screaming at the top of the husky voice, silence runs out of my lungs through cracked and bitten lips. This just feels like, again, she has no voice. She has no ability to be herself. Did you ever watch, what's it called? Garfunkel and Oakes. They're like kind of like folk singer parody girls.
No.
Okay, so they did have a Netflix show where they kind of like have an episode per song, and there's this one episode where they decide to pull a Little Mermaid. So they get mad that that Eric liked the Little Mermaid even though she didn't talk, and they're like, I bet a guy wouldn't even notice if I didn't talk. So they have this competition, who can date a guy the longest without ever saying a single word, and it's the Little Mermaid experiment, and they're really disgusted to find that the guys don't even notice that they don't say anything for, like, really long time. They go on, I don't know, like 6 dates each or something, and they just kind of nod and smile and don't say anything, and the guys don't notice. It's really upsetting. And it's meant as, like, social commentary. So they do it in, like, a funny way, but also in a, like, angry, serious way at the same time. So this reminds me of that, yes, silence runs out of my lungs, and it's like there's nobody paying attention. Even if she is speaking, maybe there's nobody acknowledging it. And then the staring into the ceiling kind of gives me this, like, kind of, like, disassociated kind of feeling. But I love the lines, cobwebs dangling as tattooed pictographs. Like, that is amazing. Tattooed pictographs. I really like the designs that you can see in cobwebs and the way the ice goes on windows and, like, clouds. It's all those things where you can kind of, like, I mean, you project your own crap into it. That's why there's what's it called? Rorschach test. But the idea of it being like pictograms, like you're seeing the messages just by looking at those spider webs. So I'm thinking of her like laying there, thinking about her shitty situation, seeing things in the cobwebs. Here I am, an aching skeleton. I was blown away by this whole piece. You know, it's brief, but I feel like it says a lot. It brings up a lot for me. Well done, Hats.
Mm-hmm. It was really disturbing, that little quote on that you gave about the Ariel and Mermaid dating. Like, that's disturbing. But I can see it.
Yeah. Yeah, they pull a Little Mermaid.
I have little joke hypothetical scenarios that I run with my husband that are just kind of funny that turn into long-term jokes. And one of them is, like, if I had talked about nothing on our first date except for how I like my onions, like how I don't really like to eat raw onions, but I like cooked onions, and if that's all I had talked about on our first date, like whether or not we would still be dating. But it's kind of a running joke. So now it comes up. Like, every time onions come up, we go into this long tirade about how I like my onions.
I love that.
If your own life isn't passing the Bechdel test, ditch the people you're hanging with.
Yeah. I think I agree. All right. I have a poem up for you to read by Robert Pileski.
All right. This is Heart Sundering by Robert Pileski. Nightmares, the demons of dreams, come down to check if I'm brave enough to look into the dark recesses of my mind. I keep my nightmares to myself on silent mode, run away from my feelings, it's my solve, for to speak of such things gives substance to the fog. That is more than this heart can take. For some nightmares are not the stuff of fiction, yet the reality that must be lived. I clench my fists and try not to scream, hiding the noise of skeletons dancing in the mind's closets. Their screams echoing through the body reverberate against my eardrums, bouncing back and forth until my mind fractures. The new love is the most beautiful of the dreams and the worst of the nightmares, but the nightmare is the horse that will carry me home after I have explored the darkness and live both my dreams and my nightmares at the very same time. End poem.
Great read. I'm impressed that even with your cold, you've been able to, like, read really clearly. I wasn't sure at first if it was going to be all snuffly and I was going to have to take over, but, you know, like, you have done amazing throughout all the reads, so good job, bad there. And Robert, I really enjoyed this poem. I like how you talk about how, you know, new love is the best dreams and the worst nightmares, because when something is really exciting and important to us, that's when we get afraid, you know, is to lose the thing. And that's why people play it safe and they don't open up their hearts sometimes, because to open yourself to love, to the best kind of joy, is to risk losing it. And, you know, those, the most beautiful dreams of, like, what if the future went great, live at the same time in your head as the nightmares of what if it doesn't go well, what if that person dies, what if that person rejects you. There's so many ways that that could go wrong. And I like that you said that the dreams and nightmares are at the very same time, because that is something that can definitely be the case. You know, some people are super optimistic and they focus on the dream part. Some people are really pessimistic and focus on the nightmare part, but they're both there. And if you're kind of somewhere in the middle, then you're overwhelmed by the two of them and their contrast. And it talks about that running away from the feelings. It's myself. For to speak of such things gives a substance of the fog that is more than this heart can take. You know, it makes the scariness more real if you let the joy be more real. I think that's a message that a lot of people can relate to. How did you see it, Babbler?
Very similarly, I enjoyed this write a lot. The idea of nightmares being the demon of dreams, you know, the dark side of dreaming, you know, it really talks about, to me, like, the ups and the downs. You know, you don't really want to talk about the nightmares and the things that you're really afraid of. You know, it kind of goes into that line, you know, for some nightmares are not the stuff of fiction, yet the reality that must be lived. Yeah, there's nightmares that exist are certainly just nightmares, you know. But there are other nightmares that are reality, that are things that you have to deal with every day. And you don't really want to talk about them, but there they are. You know, and part of that is in this last stanza, you know, the new love. That is the dream, right? Right. That's the beautiful thing. That's that, you know, anxious anxiety, the joys of it, the comfort that comes with it. But you know what they say, like, the harder you climb, the farther you can fall. Suddenly your nightmares are very different. They're much more realizable. They're much more anxiety-inducing because they're no longer, like, they're about you, but they're also about the people around you. You know, nightmares start to become, like, what if they die, or what if I die, or what if I'm not here for them, or what if, you know, all of these horrible things potentially happen, and now that's all wrapped up in the strength of your feelings for another person, and they're all very realizable. You know, just as the love is realizable, so is the alternative. So I like this. It felt like a very realistic take, you know, on dreams and nightmares and unspeakable things, you know, things you don't want to talk about happening. You know, and some of it seems and feel so irrational. Like, I know, like, every mom that I've ever met is so paranoid about their kid being, like, kidnapped and molested. And I'm not saying that that doesn't happen, but it's not like every person on the corner is a kidnapper and molester, okay? But they care so deeply about their child that, like, that they live with this constant paranoia of this thing that, while unlikely to happen, could happen. And so they're, like, always on edge about it, like, always. So, you know, I think the depths of feelings are just really interrelated in that way, and I think this piece does a really good job of expressing that. Well done.
Well said, and I'm glad that you pointed out the parenting aspect, because I originally was thinking about, like, a romantic love, but the love for a child is definitely relevant here of, like, you know, your dreams, your hopes for what they'll do as they grow up, and then also that intense fear of something going wrong for them. So I'm really glad that you pointed that out. So now I'm going to read one by Cassiana Culotta, and it's called Haunting. I had to admit that it was different. Part of me feels like we needed to reconnect in order to facilitate a proper goodbye and not admit to ourselves that it was idealized. We deserve that, at least. I had missed her, but when I touched her, the ghost of the hands of another reminded me that she left. She left with the intention of never coming back. She had left. She had left me. I loved her, and maybe always will. Only loving her this time didn't feel like a sacrifice. I love myself just enough to notice. When we moved together, our bodies were the same, but contrived. Or not, she tried to teach her heart to beat for another. She left. Sleeping beside her reminded me of sleeping without her. Hearing her apologize only reminded me of what she was sorry for. The fact was, she left me, and she couldn't unleave me. For the remainder of the time we would spend together, when she left a room, I couldn't help but think of what I felt like when she didn't come back. Even when she brushed her teeth, I was reminded her toothbrush still probably sat in the holder of someone else's sink. I tried to love her, but not fearlessly like I had in the past, because I wondered what it would have meant for me. I refused to find out what it may have meant for my soul to knowingly live in a haunted house. And poem.
Excellent read, Faziana. And I really love this piece. You know, dealing with someone who cheated on you or abandoned you and then came back, and trying to forgive and trying to put things aside and remember the way that you used to felt, just be haunted by the knowledge that this happened. You know, it's a great undermining of trust. You know, how can you trust them like you did before, when you trusted them so fully and they took advantage? You know, like, how do you come back from that? And I love the idea of it as a haunting, you know, to always have everything tainted by the memory that they weren't as dedicated to you as you were to them, that they were able to leave and now they can't unleave because everything they do is a reminder of the fact that they did it before and they could do it again and that you aren't as important to them as they are to you. You know, sometimes you want to forgive people, but you can't. It's not even really forgive. You can't forget. You know, you may have forgiven them, but you can't forget about it. It leaves scars, and they're not always easy to get over or to, you know, get around. And sometimes the only way to move on from them is to actually move on. I loved that last line, you know, the last line, you know, I refuse to find out what it may have meant for my soul to knowingly live in a haunted house. You know, it's not a lack of love anymore. It's a lack of trust and an inability to forget scars. So I thought this was a beautiful piece about infidelity. It was really well done. What did you think, Faziana?
I agree. I think it's really powerful, and it is about that change in trust, and it's the trust of the other person, but it's also, I think, the trust of yourself, of knowing that you can't fully let go because of how it happened before, because of that knowing that that you were wrong to believe in them the same way that you did in the past. And I think you're right. It's not about a lack of love. There is that love. I tried to love her, but not as fearlessly as I had. There, you know, enjoying being with them and still caring about them, but knowing that it could go wrong. And then to have the bravery to end it, knowing that there would always be that difference between them, and it doesn't matter, like, you know, that they still had those feelings. They knew that it wasn't gonna be the same after that infidelity. I think it was really powerful, and I liked the repetition. I thought there was an important repetition of left. She left with the intention of never coming back. She had left. She had left me. You know, it's repeating, but it also changes it. She left the place. She left the relationship. She left the person. And the leaving hurt on multiple levels, and that's recognized with the repetition throughout the poem, and that feeling of abandonment and how that influenced the partner who was left behind. She couldn't unleave me was a really important part, I felt. This was really sad, and I like that it kind of went through the everyday kind of things that made her think about it, like the when she brushed her teeth and things like that, those little moments that are really important, those everyday kind of things that really hit harder than the big things sometimes. So I thought this was brilliant. I think that it was very human. It felt authentic. Nicely done. Now, unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're not going to get a chance to do all of the poems. We have two or three carryovers that we will read next week, not forgetting about them, including yours, Babbler. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's mine. We really have one carryover. I just wasn't sure if we had enough for tonight, but we had plenty to talk about.
We did. We had some that were hard not to keep talking about. So, you know, it's good. I like that we have the kind of poems that get us talking. And we can definitely read yours next week. I was just going in order down the board. So thank you, everyone, who wrote to the wrote to my contest and contributed. And, like, I didn't see a poem from Pam, but I noticed she commented on every poem, or at least most of the poems. So thank you, Pam, for supporting our writers. I will be commenting on them all eventually. Thank you, Babbler, for being here, even though you're not feeling well. I appreciate you.
Thank you.
And thank you to Fill My Eyes for giving us the time on your station. Good night, everyone. I hope to see you again next week.
Good night, everybody.